welcome to Movie Film Studios, a movie podcast where we unravel and then re-ravel the best that Hollywood has to offer. I'm Isaac.
And I'm AJ.
And this week we're looking at the new Pirates of the Caribbean film.
Yes, dead men tell no fairy tales yes. about stuff.
We're actually in a bit of a sweet spot at the moment. We decided that, I think last week we talked about potentially doing Valerian, City of a Thousand Stars, Galaxy City Stars.
Yep.
Or Dawn of the War of the Planet of the Apes.
That's the one.
They're still out at the movies at the moment. And yes. And what we've found is that the necessity for us to to pause films and talk about them all the way through has meant that it's much easier for us to get the Blu-ray releases.
Yes.
It also works really well for a timing perspective, because if you haven't seen a film by the time that it's come out on Blu-ray or DVD, then I think that's the statute of limitations for spoilers.
Yes.
So what we'll be doing, I think, for the next couple of weeks is looking at those new Blu-ray releases. And what's really good for us now is that it's a couple of months after the American summer blockbuster releases. So you have your Wonder Woman's, you have your Spider-Man Homecoming, you have your Transformers 5.
Yes,
obviously, this week we looked at Pirates of the Caribbean 5. So there's all those middle-of-the-road Hollywood films, which have all sort of come out at the same time and really offered us a smorgasbord of films to look at and deconstruct.
Indeed. And I did like the way that you said that there's a necessity for us to pause the film to, and I quote, talk about it, as if we're going into civil discourse about the relative merits of what we've been watching and not swearing profusely.
Let's not get into just what we think about our film this week, as we discussed Pirates of the Caribbean 5. And first up, we're going to do a recurring segment you may remember from last week, is Jumanji Watch.
Yep.
Because this week we've actually got a new Jumanji trailer.
Brand new.
As part of our This Week in Trailers, I think for as much as we can do, we'll talk about the Jumanji film every week as it as it turns out.
Absolutely.
So this week's Jumanji trailer sort of shows us a little bit more about the world that they're exploring.
Yeah,
it does a lot more sort of fan service. So one of the opening shots is of the original game buried in the sand. They dig it up and they say, essentially, it's dismissed because it's like no one plays board games anymore. And there's a thing that
says,
the curse always finds a way or something like
that.
So
yes.
as a way of, like, you know, it's an entity in its own right. And although it's inhabited a board game, which was a, you know, popular medium for luring in little kids. That sounds very strange.
Very strange.
It's transitioned into the video game. So it gives context for the curse. I know we discussed last week, I liked the idea that that green crystal gem was the source of the curse, but it seems they've contextualized it a little bit more.
Yeah.
And also what they've done is shown us more of the world of Jumanji, more inside the jungle itself.
Yes, they did do that. One of the things, just going back to that fan service thing, which, to be fair, was maybe two or three shots totaling about 3 seconds of footage where they actually show the original game board and what looks to be Bonnie Hunt's character's house from the first film as well, for reasons. I don't know. I'm assuming that that house is... Well, that's the thing, though. That house makes no sense because at the end of Jumanji, everything goes back in time to when Robin Williams was a kid.
Yes, and before the Kirsten Dunst and Monkey Boy's parents had died in the car accident.
Yeah, so. And then they meet up again. Like, the Kirsten Dunst and Monkey Boy then meet Robin Williams
and
Bonnie Hunt in that the future from that point. This is getting weird.
Yeah, I don't really remember what they do with the board game. Do they bury it or do they throw it in the river?
They hurl it off into the ocean.
Oh, is that right? And then you see a shot at the very end of the boom boom boom.
Yeah,
boom,
and
boom,
they're
boom,
in,
boom, 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 boom,
there's
boom.
Some people walking on the beach and they're speaking in French or Japanese or something.
Interesting.
And they're like, "What's that sound?" And then it cuts to black on an ominous note.
I think we can get caught up for a long time in how this film actually fits into the Jumanjiverse.
Yes.
But really, I think the real takeaways from the new trailer are this. There seems to be like a city or a marketplace or like a bazaar in the Jumanji world. There seems to be New Zealand comedian Rhys Darby.
He's in there.
Popular boy band superstar.
One of Jonas.
Blank Jonas.
Tom Jonas.
Tom Jonas is there.
No relation to Tom Jones.
But Look, I mean, to be fair, there's not a lot more revealed. You still have your helicopter action sequences. You still have your rhino charges, your hippo kills.
Yep.
They show little bits and more pieces about the how the video game mechanics works in terms of the characters having special powers, having lives,
they can
things
bring up,
like that.
They can bring up a little menu that shows what their strengths and weaknesses are. And Dwayne The Rock Johnson's weaknesses are none.
None. And Kevin Hart
Kevin Hart's is
cake and speed and strength.
Yeah.
It feels very much to me more like a comedy than Jumanji was. Jumanji was a family action. And because Robin Williams was there, there was a sense of lightheartedness to it. Whereas this one very much feels like they're hitting the comedy angle as hard as possible.
Absolutely. But not even good comedy. It's that kind of comedy that comes about from that kind of Freaky Friday style.
It's a body switch movie. We're doing a body switch movie.
That's all it is, right? With a couple of video game tropes in there to make it fun for the kids.
Yeah.
There was actually a very in that trailer as well. There was a joke in it that I thought was very much in poor taste.
I didn't notice it until you pointed it out.
Where it's established that Kevin Hart's character has a weakness for cake, sort of in the middle of the trailer.
Yeah.
And then the last bit of the trailer shows him eating cake. The character's saying to him, isn't your weakness cake?
In the middle of the crowded marketplace.
Yep. And as per episode one, because I can't do a Kevin Hart impersonation, he will be British. And Kevin Hart responds, no, not at all. Like, I nothing seems to be happening. I seem to be fine. And then he explodes.
Explodes in the middle of a crowded marketplace.
And not a video gamey explosion with, you know, a fun explosion.
Not your character just died, you're now going to respawn.
Yeah.
Suicide vest type explosion. It's
in a marketplace. And I was like, that doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
That's not even, I mean, it's not funny.
That's the thing. Like, I looked at it and it's just a bad joke. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. In the world of Jumanji, it's a comedy for comedy's sake rather than fitting in with the universe. Yeah. Did not even think of those sort of implications.
No.
But I also think the movie creators didn't think of it either.
Probably not, no. And I'm assuming at some point there will be some kind of hoo-ha about it. But anyway, let's move on.
I mean, we're still going to go see it anyway. We're going to see Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. And so you also pointed out in this one, there's the common trend in trailers to put in a slow, dark,
a brooding remix of an old song of some kind.
We'll talk about Geostorm a little bit later, but in the original teaser trailer, they have Louis Armstrong's What a Wonderful World, but like pitched down and slowed down and showing all these natural disaster things. They do it
Wait, hang on. We've switched to Geostorm, haven't we?
No, we're going to talk about Geostorm in a moment.
All right.
In this one, it's just Welcome to the Jungle. It's like, we don't need to slow this down. Put it in exact. We've called the film Welcome to the Jungle so we can use this song in our trailer.
Yep.
We are not paying anyone to re-record this. No. We're going to use the original Guns N' Roses.
Yep.
Just chuck it over the top.
Yep.
Slap the title up. It hits the screen. Dust clouds explode. Welcome to the Jungle.
And I can only assume that the cost of licensing that song means they must use it at every opportunity. Sort of like how they paid Marlon Brando $3 million for for his appearance in Superman 1, and then decided that they needed to keep using it again.
And that performance shows up in crystals for Superman Returns.
It
shows up in flashbacks in Superman. I don't really know.
Superman 2, I think, in the director's cut, they might have reused bits and pieces from it just because he's in the film in the first Superman for all of, 5 minutes or something?
Yeah, 5 minutes at the start.
I'm assuming that now Welcome to the Jungle not only appears in the trailer, but is in the film as well at some point. And not during an end credit thing either. I'm talking middle of the action. The symphonic score that they used for the rest of the film is suddenly dropped, and then Axl Rose.
Now
it'll be that. That's what's going to happen. But let's move on because we did watch two other trailers. I feel like
we definitely want to hold Geostorm to last. It was too perfect. So we'll talk about
Tomb Raider.
Tomb Raider. Is it just called Tomb Raider, or does it have like a colon Tomb Raider: Rise of the Adventures of Tomb Raider?
No, it can't. It's a reboot. It has to have the pure original name. It can't have a colon. It's the unwritten rule of reboots. It has to go back to.
It should. I mean, if it's that rule, then surely it just should be called Croft. Like, they just take the single word last name.
Go
that's the reboot.
Go for the Logan approach there.
Rocky or Balboa or whatever it's called.
Yeah, fair enough. So the reboot of the Tomb Raider franchise, from what I can see, seems to follow almost exactly the relatively recent reboot of the video game series, which the video game series actually goes very, very violent and very gritty and grisly. And I'm thinking that depending on what this film is rated, they're going to try and go down that road. But I'm assuming because they're not pushing for an MA or a hard R rating on this film, it's going to be the kind of M15 plus style gritty violence where they cut away at the last second and don't actually show anything but still trying to be gritty.
Yeah, I mean, I only caught snippets of this trailer before today when we sat down and watched it, and I had sort of some misgivings about casting, about style, but in its entirety, the film, the trailer actually looks kind of good. Like, is it Alicia Vikander or something along those lines? Deus Ex Machina, yep. And the Guy Ritchie Man from U.N.C.L.E. I think she's in that one as well. And she's been great in all the films that I've watched her in. So her casting as Lara Croft seems fine.
Yep.
There seems to be a lot like that sort of action-y, adventure-y kind of sort of very, very Indiana. It's not really Indiana Jones-ish because it seems like there's too much gameplay mechanics of spikes shooting out of walls and jumping off aeroplanes. And I mean, I get that.
It's very video gamey.
It is. It feels very much like a video game. There's a whole bunch of sort of puzzle box things that they show in the trailer, finding clues, moving on, taking on bad guys, beating traps.
And
I didn't play the Rise of the Tomb Raider video game series. I have seen little bits and pieces of it. I don't think the bow and arrow thing really showed up for her character in the original video game series.
Not in the original. But in the reboot, it's in there.
Is in there, and it seems to be featured quite a lot in the trailer as well.
So I've played that game, and it was okay. It was kind of an Uncharted ripoff as well, except that at every possible opportunity, they tried to inject that kind of very visceral style of violence, right?
Right.
So she gets beat up and beat up pretty hard. If you screw up jumps or die, the death sequences are incredibly violent, and I can't see this film doing that at any point. But
it needs to be marketable. It needs, again, when we talk about it all the time, the end line is you need to get people into the cinema to watch it, and by beefing up the violence, you're just limiting a huge portion of your audience who can actually go and watch it.
Yep.
I'd be interested to see. I don't think there's a lot of comedy that we can derive from it.
I think it's a film. It's a quantity of film, right? You go in there and say, I'd like a... It's like when you go to the butcher and you just say, I'd like a pound of beef.
Yeah. It doesn't need to be Scotch fillet. It doesn't need to be the best premium cut. It's just... Although, you know, I'd like to hope that it's not just another film that they've just churned out. It looks like there's some stylistic integrity to it.
Yeah,
but
of course. You still enjoyed that quantity of beef. Like, you can cook it up and make some decent meat pies out of it or just some nice fried mince. It's fine. Everyone loves that.
Yeah.
But it's not going to be like your filet mignon of movie-going experiences, but it's still enjoyable on any night you can't be bothered cooking. But speaking of things that will draw an audience...
Oh, right. Okay, you go.
Let's talk about Geostorm, because this is a trailer that we watched twice and then went back and watched the first trailer, because there's now two of them out there.
Yes.
It looks magnificent.
It looks phenomenally... I don't even know.
So the trailer
2 starts, and Jared Butler rocks up late to a meeting of Congress.
A Senate hearing.
And stuffy business-minded politician goes, you take it.
What's his name? This is Michael Bastian. Let the records know that he was 1 hour late for this Senate hearing.
Yeah, I was 1 hour late because I just came from space.
What? And it just goes from there. Like, and it's got this weird 60s, 70s rock and roll track that feels very much like you're driving down the Mekong River in the Vietnam War on the back of like a boat.
Yeah.
And it's a spaceship flying into a satellite station, which has the ability to drop these bombs into clouds to control the weather.
So from what we can tell, the whole premise of this film is that we're in the future, obviously, at some point.
The not too distant future.
Not too distant future. And humanity has the ability to control the Earth's weather. And of course, that ability is governed and ruled by the US because...
For some reason, the president has the codes to...
Yes.
But, you know, obviously, lots of people die every year from natural disasters. So
right.
this is a good thing. It helps prevent flooding. Yep. It helps prevent storms that kill people. But, something goes wrong and a whole village in Afghanistan gets frozen to death.
Yep.
And they're just like, let's hope that this doesn't go wrong again.
Yep.
But,
well, not even that. Like, their solution is... So it's sort of established that there's multiple satellites out in orbit that are controlling the Earth's weather. And one of them goes wrong. So Afghanistan freezes. And there's, you know...
Icicle people.
There are the people
popsicles.
Literally
just in the middle.
Frozen.
Like, yeah.
And the UN's going through there and going, oh my God, what's going on? And their solution is shut down every satellite.
Yes.
That's it.
I think this is the meeting, the Congress meeting is, oh, we can't have this going on. A few people died.
Shut them all down.
It's like, you can't do that. I just came from space.
Yeah. So the president, played by Andy Garcia.
Andy Garcia has
the codes to shut down all this, and stuff happens. Planes fall out of the sky. Tidal waves
things
take
go,
over the city.
I think the premise is that it wasn't an accident. Someone has hijacked the system and is causing global weather catastrophes all over the world.
Sinister.
Only Gerard Butler and the guy from 21 who can count to 21 really good, and Abby Cornish and Woody, not Woody Harrelson. Who is that?
Someone, I can't
remember. Yeah, someone. Anyway. Ed Harris. It was Ed Harris.
That's it. So it's this cast.
And Abby Cornish. Did I mention Abby Cornish?
You did mention Abby Cornish. Yes, they're
the
should only
mention
ones.
Her twice because she's really good at driving as things collapse.
Yes, that's right. And the president is impressed. This is the kind of film where they took every single weird science technology thing that's in the news right now.
Yes.
That's climate change, space travel, and self-driving autonomous vehicles and jammed it all together.
It really should have been called The Day After Tomorrow, Gravity,
that's right,
White House Down, because it's got people in space trying to survive as space things explode. It has weather catastrophes destroying the world.
Yep.
It has trying to protect the president as things are blowing up.
Yes.
It is every Roland Emmerich film rolled into the one film.
It's glorious.
It is batshit bananas crazy, and it looks so stupid, it might actually be fun.
Now, to anyone that is going to go out and watch this trailer, I thoroughly urge them to do that. Watch trailer 2 first, then go back and watch trailer 1, because
this
is
crazy,
insane.
So
difference
we talked about how it had Louis Armstrong's "What a Wonderful World" with that slow melodramatic cover, building over these sort of shots of things getting destroyed and slow motion buildings collapsing and people running away from tidal waves. They're exactly the same shots that they used in number 2.
In
trailer 2, it's a different soundtrack. It's that Vietnam era upbeat, spaceships flying.
Yeah.
There's people doing jokes, like these lighthearted jokes over the same shots that have this very sort of dramatic feel in the first trailer.
I couldn't believe the difference in tone. So the first trailer has no dialogue in it whatsoever. It's just a collection of shots showing devastation and all the Earth's all the climate events that are going on the planet, with the very emotional, very dramatic, pared-down cover of What a Wonderful World. Then trailer 2, exact same footage with some more in there.
Yeah.
No What a Wonderful World, full of quippy, weird, semi-trying-to-be-funny dialogue. And it's like, what is this film? Is it a drama? Is it a comedy?
I don't know. I think like it feels very much like 2012.
Yep.
Because I wouldn't be surprised if some of exactly the same shots from 2012 are being used in this film causeways collapsing, of the Earth being ripped apart as trains go flying out of tunnels that no longer connect to anything.
Yep.
I feel as though tonally it's exactly the same kind of film.
Oh, for sure.
But they just can't make up their mind with the trailer, whether they want one trailer to show this gritty, dark, end of the world thing, or whether they want the other trailer to be this sort of fun action comedy.
Well, I mean, if there's one thing that'll sell you on this film, there's a title card in the middle of it that says, "From the producer of Independence Day."
Yes.
Not the director.
Not the director.
Not the writer.
Not the writer.
Not anyone else who has more of a creative input into the film. The producer.
And now, they I'm sure the producer didn't do anything. They're just like, no. We need to claim that we had a producer from Independence Day in the title. Who is a producer from Independence Day that is not doing anything, who can just do like a set visit one day, can just come by and just say, oh, well, I mean, what do you think of this show? I think it's pretty good. You're a producer now in the credits. You're in the trailer. Done.
So how does one get promoted to executive producer?
I think you actually have to do something. To be fair, I do actually think it's the other way around.
I think you have to do less.
I think executive producer is one of those things that they just give you. It's like if you've been in a TV show for 5 seasons, then you're an executive producer, but you don't do anything extra, whereas the producers do actually do the
The
work.
So. I mean, the relevance of executive producer is really laid to bear when you realize that Steven Spielberg is the executive producer of the Transformers films.
Oh, there was one summer I was working in a cinema where he was the executive producer of every film that was in the trailer reel. So it was like Eagle Eye with Shia LaBeouf.
Yep.
Like just every, there was probably a Transformers that was released then as well. Just every single film, there was about 6 of them in that trailer reel, he was an executive producer on. I'm like, I'm sure he just watches them.
I don't think he does though.
Like,
How could someone like Steven Spielberg, who has directed Schindler's List, The Color Purple, Munich, how could he watch War Horse? Yeah, the horse that went to war.
No, that's fine. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what he has to do. It's just like the script goes onto his desk. He's like, Eagle Eye, that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
Executive producer.
That's right, yeah. Right.
Transformers 3, plane crash, Transman bomb, executive produce, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, oh no, I directed that one. Oh.
Jurassic World.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, speaking of films that are terrible.
So this week's feature film was Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales.
Yep.
Again, I have a problem with that title. The third film's called Dead Man's Chest, and this one's called Dead Men Tell No Tales.
Dead Men get a lot of stuff in this series.
I mean, is Pirates of the Caribbean 6 going to be Dead Man's Bluff? Or is that Blind Man's Bluff? Is that Billy Goat's Gruff? Come up. Don't call the film. If you've got 5 films in the title, each one needs to be uniquely identifiable.
Yep.
So when you're talking about it, you can say, oh, you know, Dead Man's Chest. Is that the 5th one? No, that was Dead Man Tells No Tales. Wasn't the 7th one? No, that was Dead Man Goes to Hollywood.
Yep.
Well, I mean, it's just absolutely bananas. And the thing is, The phrase Dead Men Tell No Tales has very little bearing on the film itself.
Yeah, because...
Except when Javier Bardem, just before they sort of pull back and show Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales, awkwardly works in the film title into what he's saying to Orlando Bloom's son's character. Just like, because Dead Men Tell No Tales. Pull back. Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales.
Yeah.
Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales. It's just utterly ludicrous.
Yeah.
And still, not by a long shot, the worst part about that film in any way.
Oh my God. All right, let's do some disclosure here for a start. I like the Pirates films, right? I don't think that they're bastions of filmmaking in any stretch of the imagination, but the first 3 films, well, we'll talk about the third one a little bit, but I thoroughly enjoyed the first 3 films.
I'm going to jump in and say I think the first film, Curse of the Black Pearl, I think something along those lines, is a very, very good film.
It is.
It is. Absolutely. It is outstanding. I really disliked the rest of them.
Sure.
I mean, it goes downhill pretty quickly.
It does, yeah.
In a way where I don't think you can end a second film on a cliffhanger and be satisfied.
Mm.
I think they're about 2 hours into number 2, the name I cannot remember for the life of me. World's End?
One. Dead Man's...
The one that we've just been talking about.
It's Dead Man's Booty. Dead Man's Chest. I don't know.
2 hours into that, I'm just like, they can't possibly resolve all these story things in the amount of time they have left.
No.
And then it just ends and it says, you're going to have to pay for the next one to find out what happens. And I walked out of the cinema going, you're not allowed to do that.
Mm.
They did that to me with The Matrix and I was pissed off.
Yep.
And they did it to me with this one. I'm just like, I can't abide by what you've done here.
Yeah, this is back in like the mid-2000s when doing back-to-back sequels, both in terms of production and in release, was a thing that they decided to do.
So 2006, 2007 were the second two Pirates films.
The Matrix was 02, 03.
Yeah, sounds about right.
Then Harry Potter did it in...
That was much later on. I think Lord of the Rings was consecutive years, wasn't it? I think that's...
I think they might have skipped a year at some point. But I mean, like, the Lord of the Rings has an excuse, right? Like,
but I mean, you know, they filmed that for 10 years before they started actually sort of releasing the films. Yeah. I mean, Peter Jackson was working on it for 10 years, essentially, and had all this sort of stuff. So it wasn't you film the entire film in that 12-month period, edit it, put it together and release it. They'd had so much backed up.
Yep.
I think it was 2001, 2002, 2003, or thereabouts.
Yep.
For those films, whereas this one was very much just a half-baked idea, I think, that they when they started making it, they went, oh, we can't fit all this into the one film. We're going to have to break it up. And there was no... At least with Harry Potter Deathly Hallows, it was called Deathly Hallows Part 1.
Mm.
You knew they were splitting that up. They did the same with the Hunger Games later on.
There's an expectation. It's like,
you are going to have to watch half the film now and half the film later. Yep. They did not set the expectations for that second film at all.
Regardless of the merits or the opposite of merits of the other Pirates films, let's talk about this one. Because this one was beyond awful.
Yes.
I
think there was no more than 5 minutes between cringes in this film. There's just cringeworthy moments happening all the time that you can't get engrossed into the story of the film. You can't put yourself in there because every time Johnny Depp shows up on screen, it's just a slap in the face of the Jack Sparrow character he created for the first film.
Unbelievable.
Every story, exposition, conversation is horrible. There's no chemistry between the two young male and female stars.
Yep.
There's no internal logic behind the universe of Pirates. If you try and, in your head, rationalize how this could be happening now in this film versus all of the magic and curse sort of stuff that we've seen in the previous film, it just sort of falls in on itself.
Yep.
And it's kind of heartbreaking. And I came into this film with expectations because it had semi-decent reviews. I mean, not great, but I'm just like, I thought this was going to be like a 5 out of 10 film, and it's getting sort of like, you know, 6.5, 7. I'm just like, oh, maybe it's a bit of a return to form from the...
Yeah.
I mean, we haven't even mentioned number 4, which sort of stands on its own as
let's not.
Weird nexus of a... Doesn't fit in with the original trilogy. They didn't get any of the stars to come back.
Nope.
And then... This sort of came along, I'm like, is this going to be a sensible retelling with that sort of fun action that they sort of... But it's just not there.
And that's what I wanted it to be. I saw the trailers for this film when they came out, and I was excited for it. I wanted that kind of, let's go back to that fun, playful kind of... That playful, fun kind of film mixed together with decent action and a decent story and decent characters that feel, you know... compelling and have decent relationships. And in this we got... It's not even that case where reboots will try and just basically take the original film and retell it and sort of hit the notes that the original film did.
Yeah.
This film didn't even do that.
No.
Right? You could almost see they were trying to do that in the sense that they have It literally was discount Orlando Bloom because he's playing
Orlando Bloom's
son.
He's got an excuse this time for being just a discount version of the original character because he is legitimately the son of that character.
Just before we... Obviously, spoilers, whatever.
I mean...
I don't care. But so we've got discount Orlando Bloom. Then we've got a female lead, discount...
Keira Knightley
Portman, whatever.
Yes.
Who, and at some point, by the end of the film, those two characters are together. At no point during the film is there any reason for that to happen.
There's a couple of really awkward conversations they have where you can tell that the writers are trying to build character and build a rapport between them, but it just doesn't work.
No.
It's just them saying lines to one another and then... sort of smiling, going, oh, we just flirted. And it's like, no, you didn't.
Yeah.
No, you didn't at all.
That's no.
Now, we discussed after we finished the podcast last week that we should introduce a section or a segment at the top, which is recounting the story or plot of the movie in 2 minutes, I think we gave ourselves.
Sure. Yep.
Just because not everyone that's going to be listening to this would have seen the film.
Yep.
And just by trying to put it in a bit of context, we start from the beginning, work our way through, and try and speed run the film to give people a sense of what it was about and what the main sort of story was. It's going to be super hard for this
really
one.
Hard
because I don't even think the writers know what the story is. The characters' motivations are unclear. Plot points as to why things are happening are unclear. There's built-in redundancies for, like, the two groups of antagonists chasing the bad guys. He's like, there does not need to be the Javier Bardem pirate ship of dead ghost pirates. And there does not need to be the obligatory, the English shall rule the seas and we should take you over. And I'm David Wenham and I am Australian, but somehow playing an English person. They both don't need to be there. And then partway through the film, they just crush the English guys. It's like, we don't know why we had them in our story. And just, if we just kill them now, then you don't have to think about it. It's just like, so do you want to attempt this 2-minute run?
This is going to be impossible. The reason why, like, plot points are still being added to the film about an hour and 40 minutes in. And I'm not talking about, like, stuff that's a continuation.
Major character reveals.
Yeah, nothing that's a continuation of stuff at the start, but, like, brand new story points that have had no bearing on the story whatsoever until this point.
I'm going to say go, and you have 2 minutes.
Go. Orlando Bloom's son is on a ship, and Salazar Slytherin comes on board, who's played by Javier Bardem, who's eating every single bit of prop he can. What do you call it when an actor does that? He's chewing the scenery. He's chewing every bit of scenery on the set. He tells him that he's after Jack Sparrow because Jack Sparrow did something to him at some point in the park.
You've missed it. You've missed
already?
The opening sequence where Discount Orlando Bloom was a son. And
oh, yeah, of course.
So the opening sequence is him almost drowning himself to get onto the Flying Dutchman to tell Orlando Bloom, who is his dad, that I'm going to find a way to break your curse and free you from this ship that you're on.
Yep.
The only way to do it is to find Neptune's trident.
Yep. And of course, that means that this film only works if you've seen every other Pirates film
it's
as well.
It's not an independent film at all.
Because it makes no sense to anyone that has never seen these
so
films.
So then
cut to 9 years later. 9 years later.
They're chasing pirates. The pirates go into the Devil's Triangle.
Yep.
Discount Orlando Bloom.
Yep.
Henry Turner says, don't go in there. It's cursed in there.
Yep.
They don't listen. They go in there.
Yep.
Javier Bardem kills everyone except for Discount Orlando Bloom.
Yep.
Doubloon? We call him Doubloon because he's Discount Orlando Bloom. And Doubloon then goes, Javier Bardem's like, I only leave one person alive so that he can tell the tale. Then I don't even know where to go.
So then we cut to a seaside town of some kind,
like
somewhere
Santa Maria
in the,
or some Caribbean
some
town.
Some big Caribbean town.
Which is quite clearly Queensland.
Yeah,
it's probably just off the
really,
Gold Coast.
It really is Queensland. And anyway, they're unveiling a new bank. And they've got this new safe in there, and then for some
Jack
reason,
Jack Sparrow's asleep in the safe, and he's drunk. And they to try and rescue the safe, they drag the entire building through the town.
Well, they're not rescuing the safe; they're trying to rob it.
Yes.
Right? So there's this,
but the safe's open, and the gold's flying everywhere, and they ultimately fail. But there's this weird sequence where we're introduced to Effie from Skins, who is Discount Keira Knightley, or I can't even think of a portmanteau of that. And she's introduced because I confess that I can pick handcuffs, and I confess that I'm a scientist and I like looking at the stars, and then everyone else is like, you're a witch. And there's a 30-minute sequence here where every character is captured and escapes at least twice for no apparent reason.
Yeah.
So Doubloon is chained up in hospital and escapes. Effie the witch is in hospital and escapes. Jack Sparrow is locked in a safe and then escapes, and then they're all captured.
Yep.
And so they're going to hang them and behead them respectively.
Yep.
And then Doubloon comes in and tries to rescue them, but fails, but it's a distraction and they all escape again.
Yep.
And then later on, there's this weird section in the middle where they land on an island in the middle of nowhere for no reason and capture Jack Sparrow and try and marry him off to some ugly wench. And there's no reason for the sequence to be there. And we both screamed in frustration there's absolutely no point to it.
Let's backtrack for a second here just to give some context behind that scene, what little there is. So essentially, all these characters come together through very, very stupid reasons. And the whole idea is that they're all united to try and find the Trident of Neptune, which is the MacGuffin of this film. And that Trident will give them dominion. Okay, fine.
Because
it's a MacGuffin then, not the MacGuffin. So this scepter or trident is meant to give them dominion over the sea.
And can break all ocean-bound curses.
Exactly. So it's the source of every single curse that's ever happened on the seven seas, including all the stuff you've seen in the previous films.
Well, I don't want to...
Maybe.
I think there's Aztec gold is the curse from the first one, right? And I'm not sure that's necessarily an aquatic-based curse. Okay. But let's not split hairs
right,
here.
Okay.
Because...
But anyway, so they're all united against it. And then we also have Javier Bardem going after Jack Sparrow because Jack Sparrow, in his youth, trapped him in the Devil's...
Triangle?
Sure, that's a pretty evil shape. And
the most evil of shapes is the triangle.
Yeah, and cursed him to a... not quite dead, but not, the curse when they're not dead, but they're still alive. And
but yeah, I mean, it's the same curse that everyone's been through at least once or twice during the film.
Yeah.
But for, like, it's a different curse that somehow has the same effect of half dead, half alive. Davy Jones's locker, Aztec
that's
curse.
That's right. And
Devil's Triangle curse.
And Javier Bardem, who plays a character called Salazar something, Slytherin, sure.
Yeah, sure.
Is attempting to track Jack down to. I want to say kill him.
That seems to be
for revenge. I think it's a revenge.
No one's motivations in this film are particularly clear.
No.
So it sort of starts off that he's trapped there, and he enlists the help of Doubloon to get the compass from Jack Sparrow for what we're not really clear on. But then it turns out that because Jack Sparrow is an alcoholic, he trades the compass for a bottle of whiskey, and in giving up the compass. The compass releases his number one fear, which is this guy that he'd forgotten about from his youth. And so Salazar Slytherin is now hunting him down, but there's no reason for it.
Because
Slytherin hunting Jack Sparrow down has nothing to do with the trident.
No.
The trident's only purpose then is to stop Slytherin, who is hunting Jack down. Because Jack's looking after the trident. It's this illogical loop that just goes on and on forever.
It makes no sense. And keep in mind, if you've seen the other films, it's the same compass. It's that compass that's meant to show, point you in the direction of the thing you most desire.
Most desire,
so somehow that's tied into the curse that Salazar Slytherin has. And when Jack gives away the compass, because he's never lost the compass before in any of the other films, Salazar is released from the Devil's Triangle and is now free to hunt down Sparrow.
Yes.
And I have no idea why that's the case. And then the compass has no bearing on anything after that.
But as soon as the trident becomes the focus of the search, it's also Doubloon wants it so he can free his father from the Flying Dutchman curse, and discount Keira Knightley wants it because since she was an orphan, she'd had this book that was left for her, and the book has all these sort of Indiana Jones type Grail diaries.
It's the Grail diary, and
how to get it, and like a piece of a ruby embedded in the front or something like that.
And now let's continue on that track and on in terms of where that book has come from. So this is the 1 hour 40 mark, right?
Let's go 1.5 hours. It was definitely a significant way through the film.
Yeah, we're like at the tail end of Act Two at this point, so we don't need. And we've had we know nothing about Discount Keira Knightley, really. We know nothing about where she's come from, who she is. We know that
she likes astronomy.
She's an astronomer.
And she can do maths, and because of that, she's declared a witch.
A witch,
which it feels very sort of like out of place. And I was trying to think, is it? The time frame that it's set in, I think, is probably around the 1600s. And I think the Salem witch trials might be around the same sort of time. But like that melding and merging of those worlds into the Pirates of the Caribbean just seems like, because she's accused of being a witch for no proof and is going to be sentenced to death. And then later on, we see an actual witch, which the English bad guys know is a witch, and they just kind of let it slide, and you go, well, this doesn't make any sense.
No.
You've just needed an excuse, or even like it's lazy writing it's a historical piece. Any woman who knows anything has to be then for accused of being a witch.
It's exactly that. It's a horrendously crappy crutch. But let's talk about now this book that she is in possession of. So at the 1.5 hour point, it's revealed that she's an orphan.
She's an orphan, yeah.
She was dropped off at an orphanarium.
That's what they are,
isn't it?
Yeah, sure.
Orphan house, orphan warehouse. The Discount Orphan Warehouse.
Discount Orphan Warehouse. That's why her first name is Discount and her last name is Keira Knightley.
Keira Knightley, yeah. It's a family name. So she gets dropped off there, and she has a book purportedly from her father.
Yeah.
And this book has a bunch of maps and instructions in it about how to find the location of King Neptune's trident. And so she's on this big quest to try and find it. We then learn, and we haven't actually mentioned this character yet, but we learn that for some reason, her father is Captain Barbosa.
Yeah, Jeffrey Rush's
character.
Captain, yeah.
For what?
Yeah, like it's completely out of the blue. They're having a conversation, and he's like, "Arr, what be your name?" And she's just like, "I'm named after the North Star, Keira Knightley." It's like, "Oh God, I had sex with a woman called Keira Knightley, and I dropped her and its baby off at the orphanarium, and I you must be my daughter."
Oh yeah, and Jack knows, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, like, Jack figures it out. It's like, I do believe that you had a thing for a wench called Keira Knightley many moons ago, Jar. I shall use this information to blackmail you for freedom. I'm just like, oh God.
It was bizarre.
Out of the blue.
Like, why? What possible purpose could that serve to this? Oh, it does serve something to the story, by the way, because, giant spoiler alert, they kill Barbosa at the end of the film.
Yeah, so they're climbing up an anchor chain to get out of the ocean, which is collapsing in around them, and Discount falls. Captain Barbosa catches her, and she sees a tattoo on his arm, and it's the tattoo of the constellation that they've been using all along, and she's just like, "What's my relationship to you?" Which is not the right question to ask in that situation.
Who am I to you?
And then somehow she figures out that he's her dad, and then Jack Sparrow drops a sword to him, and Jeffrey Rush drops off the anchor, falls down, stabs Javier Bardem in the back, and they escape, and it's just...
This all comes at the sort of climax of the film where the ocean gets parted, they destroy the trident, and then the ocean walls are starting to collapse back in, and the characters are all climbing up the anchor up to the Black Pearl to escape. Javier Bardem jumps on at the last minute, and there's that kind of tense moment where there's a bad guy on the end of the anchor. And so Jeffrey Rush makes the ultimate sacrifice.
He makes a sacrifice
by jumping down and stabbing Javier Bardem, and then they both get consumed by the ocean.
Yes.
It's just, why? Like, at what? Nothing in this film suggests that Barbosa is hung up about being a parent.
No.
So he literally learns about the fact that she's there at the hour and a half mark in, and then about 15 minutes later, he kills himself.
Willing to kill himself for her.
And it's just like, why?
None of the moments are earned because they don't take the time to establish character relationships. There's nothing to this film. And so the more we talk about it, the more angry we're going to get.
I just
want to bring up a point, and just to try and temper the anger, which I can see welling inside you. Let's talk about a young Johnny Depp flashback.
Oh, yeah, let's do that.
And you pointed out, I think Disney has done this Young Robert Downey Jr. In Captain America Civil War,
Young Carrie Fisher.
Young Carrie Fisher, young Grand Moff Tarkin.
I mean,
in that he's not dead.
He's technically younger than he is now, but...
Yes.
Yeah,
so it was... And this time, it's a flashback to when Javier Bardem was alive, and Jack Sparrow is supposed to be maybe a teenager, but the age of the face that they digitally compose onto this actor changes from scene to scene. Sometimes he looks about 25, and then sometimes he looks about 15.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a bit weird that it keeps bouncing back and forth between it.
Yeah, I had a very... in terms of the tech behind it, like, we're getting to a point where it's like, yeah, that's kind of impressive, but something was really up with young Johnny Depp's mouth, because it looked like... Do you remember when Conan used to do that thing where he'd just have a picture of a celebrity, and then they just superimpose someone's mouth over the top of it?
And it would always... Because as their mouth moved up and down, the picture didn't move at all. And it just seems like it's disembodied lips floating around a face.
That's what it looked like. And it was bonkersly bizarre.
Yes. And we're supposed to see this incident here where he's... taunted Salazar Slytherin into chasing him into the Devil's Triangle and dying as being his sort of like This is the moment that he was called Jack the Sparrow.
Yeah, that he became
and
the pirate.
Once he did that, he earned the respect of all of his other pirate mates, and they all come along and they put like a little token of appreciation, and they're all his little affectations. They're his hat.
Yeah.
They're the weird stick that's across his face. They're the beads that are dangling from his goatee.
Yeah.
And then also... it's also supposed to be where he got the compass as well, because the captain of the ship gets hit by a cannonball.
That's right.
And he gives the compass to him. He's like, this compass will show you the thing that you most desire. Don't betray it. Like, this weird thing. It's like, what was that thing at the end there that's never come up in any of the other films, except we've already seen that he's betrayed it and given it away earlier. So we're trying to write in that he was told that he shouldn't have done that?
Yeah, because like a single throwaway line by a dying character is definitely the way you want to... Oh, a character that we've never seen before, by the way. He
explains the magic of the world, why things are happening.
You see the first shot of him during that flashback, and then literally 20 seconds later, he's dead.
Yes.
And apparently that's a... Anyway.
And he's had the compass the whole time. I mean, what's he been doing with it? Like, if it's the thing that he desires most and he's been following it, how did it take him into a battle with a Spanish general who wants to kill all pirates?
I have to go back, actually, to that bit where they're giving him all his affectations, right? Because you can kind of cast a thread, and don't hate me on this, I'm going somewhere. That scene in Last Crusade, during the opening sequence when it's a flashback to Indiana Jones' youth,
he gets
his hat.
Also, the whip scar is the scar with
the
whip.
And the scar and the whip. Yeah, that's fine. That's a cute little
fear
thing.
Fear of snakes as well, if we're going for every Indiana Jones affectation
but at least
explained
that, that happens over a course of a big sequence, right?
Yes.
This would be, like, the pirate's equivalent would be, like, the bad guy gives Indy the hat, then he takes off his jacket and gives him that, then he pulls off his whip and gives him that, and then he says...
And he takes out his gun and says, use this in a fight scene if you have dysentery while filming in Turkey.
If some guy is swinging a sword at you and you're not feeling up for it, just shoot him with this gun.
Yeah.
You need to just point it in this direction and you use the trigger to fire. That's what this was like.
Yes.
It was just like, why is this here?
It's this real mini Jack Sparrow origins.
But was it a uniform?
Flashback.
Like, it felt like it was a uniform. Like, you know, to be on this ship, right? The code of conduct for this ship, if you want to be captain, you must wear this, these little beads, and this hat.
It's almost like those restaurants you go to, and the wait staff have to have a certain amount of badges affect like little bits and pieces, and it's just like, oh right, you've earned this piece here. But like, I mean, you would imagine that he would have collected these through a lifetime of adventures.
We assume.
But it's just this one event where he he ties a rope to a rock so he can turn his ship super fast.
Yeah.
And because of that, they give him everything that's important to him
absolutely.
In life. His nickname, his appearance, the captaincy of the ship,
all comes
the
from
compass.
One event.
One, 2-minute sequence in his life.
Mm-hmm. I look. We got incredibly angry watching the, I got incredibly angry watching this film. This we're 3 episodes into this podcast. This is officially, I can't tell which one I hate more, this film or Jurassic World. And I hated Jurassic
We've mentioned
World.
We watched Crystal
and
Skull.
And we watched Crystal Skull.
Before we started recording the podcast, watched it as with the intent of sort of talking about it.
Yeah.
That is a truly atrocious film. And I do hate Crystal Skull more.
Yep.
Just because I love Indiana Jones so much.
I agree.
It's like having your heart broken by someone you truly care about rather than having your heart broken by someone you were kind of like, I'm not sure where this relationship was going.
Yeah,
but still, a breakup hurts. And this just felt like a great big kick in the face
For sure.
To everything that you've loved about the series so far.
Ostensibly, this is a far worse film than Crystal Skull is. Take away the love of Indiana Jones from Crystal Skull.
Yeah,
it's
but
it's a bad film.
There's
yes.
still giant spinning saw blades on a truck cutting their way through a forest. I still can't get behind that.
Yeah, but what about this film?
Yeah, no, I
they pull a whole bank building.
They use like 6 horses to pull an entire bank through the streets. Like, not just the
not
safe.
Just the safe. The entire
the
building.
Entire bank. There's actually a sequence in one of the Fast and Furious films. I think it's like 5 or 6 where they do this very thing. They tie the safe to the end of cars.
Yeah.
And then they're driving through the street and the safe's trailing behind it. And they're using it like a bombie knocker to knock cars and stuff
but
around.
Just the
this
safe.
Is that sequence, but with horses.
With horses
and
the entire building.
And not just the safe, the entire building.
So like based on that logic, because cars are far more powerful than the 6 or 12 horses that they used, the cars in the Fast and the Furious franchise should have been able to pull a skyscraper along behind them. Like, that's the kind
It is insanity. It is literally...
Like,
screenwriters and filmmakers just with no common sense at all going, wouldn't it be cool if... And we've talked about this. I'm not sure if we've talked about it on the podcast, but there's the phrase, wouldn't it be cool if...
Yep.
And I think Steven Spielberg and George Lucas had that mentality for Crystal Skull.
Yep.
I think they have their mentality here, and they don't take a step back going, it would be kind of cool, but it is not within the realms of possibility within this universe for these events to be happening.
Yep.
Doesn't matter if it would be cool if... Johnny Depp stuck a cannonball up his ass and fired himself to the ship. Yep. Like, it's just, no, please, please restrain yourself to the physical limitations of the universe before you do things. And it's just...
There's two more things I want to talk about. One thing we mentioned earlier, which was the bizarre wedding sequence in this film.
Yeah.
So essentially, what happens is Johnny Depp... Doubloon and Discount Keira Knightley.
You can just call her Discount. She doesn't need to be called by her full name.
So Discount Doubloon and Johnny Depp are being chased by Slytherin, and they land on an island.
Just a random island. It just happens to be the nearest island for when Slytherin got close to them, and they decided to take a rowboat and try and...
Yeah, and now as part of Slytherin's curse, he can't touch land because why not?
Magic power. We've got to talk about magic powers. So
we do have to talk about magic powers, but there is another thing I want to talk about as well. So anyway, Slytherin and his crew can't touch land, so they retreat back to the boat where they're in discussion with Barbossa. Barbossa has made a previous deal with them to try and get Sparrow.
Yes.
So essentially, what's meant to happen after that is Barbossa's crew is meant to arrive on the island and capture Sparrow. So there's a bit of a time gap between Barbossa making it to the island and actually meeting Sparrow.
Yeah.
So to fill that gap, they've put in a really weird sequence. So the trio get captured. They fall into a net.
They enter a jungle, which means that within three or four steps, they will be hoisted into the air by a net with some sort of jungle trap that people have set up.
Yep. And then after that... They're at a wedding ceremony.
It's a wedding ceremony held in the skeletal carcass of a whale that's washed up in the beach.
By what looks like shipwrecked, I'm assuming some shipwrecked people that were marooned there.
We're assuming this. I don't know. Never explained why these people are on the island at all. Why they are setting up traps to capture people.
Mm.
And I think we're about an hour and 17 minutes in by this point.
Yep.
And there's a character that... Jack Sparrow recognizes and has betrayed in the past, and for his betrayal, this character is forcing Johnny Depp to marry the ugliest woman he's ever seen.
That's right, yeah. And they've got a minister there, and they talk about Jack making an honest woman of her.
Yeah.
And she has two kids, and it's just there.
It's just there. It is so out of place. It's so unnecessary. And
we just, this scene comes up in a film that already makes no sense, and this was the most bizarre point, because there's no reason for these characters to be there.
They disappear
afterwards.
Literally just cut the entire sequence out and you wouldn't notice, but whose fever-addled mind actually typed the words onto a script to have this made is just... astoundingly,
it had to have been like a 2 a.m. filler that someone wrote when they realized there was a time gap between Barbossa.
But they don't care. Like, later on, Salazar Slytherin possesses Doubloon, and then they're like, we're going to go get Jack Sparrow. And literally 2 seconds later, they've covered all the distance, gone back, Doubloon jumps in a fight. They don't care about time gaps.
No.
They don't care about how long things take.
No. Just for this one sequence.
They just, wouldn't be funny if he had to marry. Like, what do you...
No, it wasn't even a wouldn't be funny. It's like, oh my God, Barbossa doesn't have enough time. There's a time gap there. What are they going to do? What are the trio on the island going to do? Wedding. That'll do. That'll take up time.
Yeah.
Let's have a wedding, and it'll be with someone that that Jack has betrayed before. Jack's had plenty of adventures, right? Like, he'd be the type of person that would have double-crossed someone in the past. Ha 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 ha! Wouldn't it be funny if the person that he was forced to marry was really, really ugly? Oh, that would be funny. Great, I'll write it right now. Act it.
It's bizarre. It is truly bizarre. And we'll touch on the magic powers now, because I think that relates to that thing where I just mentioned that Slytherin possesses Doubloon. So last week we talked about with the mummy,
yes,
that whenever necessary, the mummy would develop new magic powers to be able to do things just to make special effects sequences look cool.
Not even that, just to, at some point, the existing... the existing range and scope of her powers would allow her to be defeated by whatever the good guys had.
So she's just impervious. Or they wanted to do a kick-ass sequence where all the windows in London exploded and there was a sandstorm.
Sand. Yeah.
So this is very much the same thing that they do here, where we know that Salazar is cursed.
He's undead.
He's an undead person. Mm. All right. Okay. Fair enough.
So then, power number one.
Power number one.
He can go through walls.
He can walk through the prison bars. As if the prison bars weren't there.
Yeah.
There's also a thing where there's disembodied hands, or it doesn't matter if all your body parts are attached, they'll still float in space as if they were.
Sure.
Even though there's no physical thing there.
Mm-hmm.
There is a weird thing where the ship has it's almost like a centipede, or like the face-hugging monsters from Aliens, where
sort of prow of the ship can...
The ribs of the ship open up and grab on and latch onto things. He then also has the power to reanimate dead sharks,
which
is never really explained up until the point that they throw dead sharks in the water
and
for a sequence. It's like, wouldn't it be cool if there were skeletal sharks?
Yep.
We then discover that they can't touch land, but they can walk on slightly wet sand.
Yep.
Provided their feet are still wet, that's fine.
And they can run on water?
They can run on water. That's, again, another power that shows up. It's like, if you could run on water the whole time... Why did you send dead sharks after the Johnny Depp in his rowboat? It just, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Then later on, we discover that he has the power to possess people so he can walk on land.
Yep.
But the penalty of doing that is he can't unpossess them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an hour and 52 minutes into the film. They just say, you can do this.
Yep.
Go and do it. And you're like, why?
Oh, they can breathe underwater
underwater. So, yeah, despite the fact that they can also run on the top of the water, they can, if they choose to, sink to the bottom of the water as well.
Yep.
It's a batshit array of powers that just comes out of nowhere.
Oh, hang on, we're missing one as well. The ship has a kind of big statue on the prow.
Oh, yes.
Which comes to life during an action sequence.
The maidenhead sort of on the prow.
Yep.
Can animate
just
and
comes
fight.
Alive. Yeah,
I mean, the ship's already opening up itself like a giant centipede to just devour things. Why not the wood become sentient and try and fight Johnny Depp well?
Why not?
And of course, the hell not?
Of course. Now this is going to go into the second thing I wanted to discuss, which is Jack Sparrow's character in this film. But that wooden specter, that reanimated statue, was defeated by Jack Sparrow doing some crazy...
Just crazy.
There's acrobatic crap where he pulls a cannon out.
He's holding onto the side of his ship.
Mm.
The enemy ship has a cannon pointed directly at his face.
Yeah.
You see the enemy light the fuse. He's also being attacked by an animated wooden statue who has a great big spear who's about to attack him.
Mm.
And he's like, if I just jump over there and pull the rope, the cannon will point upwards and shoot the face off the giant wooden statue.
Yep.
And he's like, what sort of Rube Goldberg machine has eventuated that you can, pull this lever and it'll do this and it'll fire that and it'll ping off this and destroy exactly what he wants it to destroy.
I need to also mention that it's the only canon in the entire, not just the film, but the entire Pirates universe that has a Looney Tunes-esque fuse on it.
delay. Everything else, you touch the fire
everything
to it,
else,
it'll
yeah,
fire.
It explodes. But for this one, no, we're going to have a nice long fuse on it.
Speaking of cannons shooting things, let's go back to the guillotine section where to escape from a guillotine, they fire a cannon at the guillotine where Johnny Depp is attached to, and it creates this sort of centrifugal thing where the whole guillotine starts spinning around with Johnny Depp in it and the blades going in and out and in and out.
Yeah.
And then... It's just one of those things, like, what did you expect to happen? These people who are trying to rescue Jack Sparrow have fired a cannon essentially at him, going, that'll free him. And then there's this, like, wackiness that just ensues.
It just...
Look, let's discuss Jack Sparrow
right
now.
We'll talk about the character rather than the stupidity of the action sequences.
By the way, I just need to explain, if it feels like we're jumping around a lot and everything is incoherent, welcome to the film-watching experience that we had, okay? So, Jack Sparrow, at the very least, the first film, doesn't come across as incompetent.
No.
Per se. He comes across as conniving. He comes across
as self-centered.
And even though it looks like he's kind of bumbling, we get the sense as an audience that he knows exactly what he's doing.
So I described it as the Jackie Chan style, the drunken master.
Yeah.
Where it appears as though you're drunk, but every move you make is quite deliberate. You're always in control.
Absolutely.
You always have the ability to attack or retreat if you want to. It just, there's the appearance on the surface, the ruse of that sort of incompetence, but you're always in control.
Now, I think that through the course of these five films, they've probably tried to go more down the slapsticky route with his character. But this one takes a massive leap into what I deem to be Mr. Magoo country.
It is, absolutely.
Because essentially, in this film, they've reduced him down to basically a drunk and all the trappings of being a drunk. And at no point...
Well, that's supposed to be his character arc. The character arc is supposed to be he's reached rock bottom.
Yeah.
The only reason that he'd ever give away this compass is for a bottle of whiskey because he's become an irredeemable drunk.
Exactly.
And it's supposed to be a position from which you can build his character back up. But instead of going, I've hit rock bottom, it is, I'm Mr. Magoo, where I can stumble around and things will happen around me and through blind luck
and
I will
get
through it all.
Yeah. And that's, you don't have that sense
and
in the other films.
He doesn't redeem himself at all.
No, he doesn't.
Now that I think about it, there's no moment at the end of the film where he goes, I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm not going to be a drunk. I've pulled myself back from this completely rotten place which I found myself in.
Yeah. And I basically said that he does nothing in this film. So essentially, he makes this film harder by releasing Slytherin.
Yes. So, I mean, he has no motivations at all. Like, he doesn't want to find the Trident. He doesn't want to re-imprison Salazar. He just gives away his compass, which sets Salazar free.
Which unlocks Salazar.
But Salazar doesn't need to be there.
No.
They're already being chased by the British Admiralty, essentially.
Mm.
There's already an imperative for them to achieve their goals. They don't need this other thing. So, Javier Bardem and Johnny Depp didn't need to be in the film.
No.
And you would have the same adventure, essentially.
And the same ending as well.
The same ending. It's just they are there for, like, Javier Bardem to be an A-list name that has some sort of zombie special effects applied to him.
Yeah.
And Johnny Depp, just because it's called Pirates of the Caribbean.
It's just... And I honestly, like, when the fourth film came out and it was very Jack Sparrow heavy, I didn't enjoy it as much.
No.
I actually prefer Barbossa as a character.
There's a great balance that they struck with the first film with Keira Knightley, Orlando Bloom, and Johnny Depp. There's a triumvirate there that they have checks and balances which sort of all work together.
Mm.
And then, I mean, I liked Barbossa's character, but he's very much the antagonist of the first film.
Yes.
And he doesn't sort of fit into that dynamic, but then they do sort of decide to jam him in there. So, again, there's another point talking about stakes. So, Marvel has a problem where there's no stakes ever for your superhero characters because you can't actually ever really kill them off.
No.
And I feel as though with Pirates of the Caribbean, they've done that Game of Thrones thing where because they've introduced the ability to reanimate characters who have died, which they did for Barbossa at the end of Pirates 2. There's no stakes for them dying or for them sacrificing themselves because you can essentially just reanimate them or you can bring them back or they cannot be there. It diminishes any sacrifice that Barbossa makes at the end of the film. I mean, it seems like a rubbish sacrifice to kill yourself to save everyone. Like maybe on paper in the script, it looked good, but on film, with the blocking of where all the characters were, you're like, that was just so unnecessary.
Yeah, it was stupid.
So it diminishes his sacrifice
completely
to because you're like, they could just bring him back if they wanted to, or like, anyway, it's just...
Well, the other thing is that it's kind of implied that the Trident is the source of all the magic.
I did want to talk about, so you talk about a broader universal mythology that they bring up in Pirates, and I kind of feel as though it is there, and I it is established, but I think the first film is just about Aztec gold, which is cursed, right?
Sure.
From that point on, they start adding in, like, real, like, it becomes much more of a plot point that this magic exists in the universe, that there are curses, that all the stories you hear of the sea, of Davy Jones's locker, of the Flying Dutchman, of the Kraken are real. Yeah. And I much more appreciated the first film because it was kind of subtle.
Yep.
There was a cursed gold, they couldn't contain their greed, and they were then sort of like cursed to be these zombies.
Yep.
And then it goes, okay, let's really delve into there with the Cajun sort of witchcraft, the Bill Nighy is an octopus man.
Mm.
Bill Nighy is an octopus man. and Stellan Skarsgård has crab claws that live on his face. I don't really know what's going on
Orlando Bloom's dad.
Yes. And then I think in the fourth one it was about the Fountain of Youth, so they've just taken another story. And this one has introduced Greek and Roman mythology with Poseidon's trident.
Yeah.
And so it sort of starts going, well, in this very sort of small section in number one where there's cursed gold, which I can kind of get behind. So there's this broad array of ghosts are real and zombies are real and mermaids and everything you've ever heard of is real.
Yeah.
It has extended and broadened the universe. I don't particularly like it that much. But at least they've, up until now, stayed within the consistent realms of the universe that they've created.
Yeah, absolutely. Whereas, it's implied in this that the Trident is the source of everything because Orlando Bloom's curse is broken at the end.
Yeah.
So they destroy the Trident, and as a result, Orlando Bloom's curse that he got from Pirates 3 is broken, so he's no longer the captain of Davy Jones's locker, and he's no longer taking souls to the next
life, job,
to the
right?
afterlife.
And he can
yeah.
only go on land once every
10 years. So the Trident is meant to be behind a lot of these things.
And so by destroying it, which they do,
you
would assume that means that the magic of the Pirates universe is gone, and maybe that's why we don't have that same sort of level of magic nowadays. It's like we've broken the Tolkien thing, right, where magic used to exist and now it's waned, and that's why we have the modern world. You think that until the post-credit scenes where Orlando Bloom is in bed with discount Keira Knightley, full price,
genuine Keira Knightley,
and he has a dream and a monster comes in and it's got a crab claw, and then he wakes up, is like, oh, it was all a dream, but then it pans down and there's some barnacles on the ground. It's like, well, if you destroyed the Trident, why are crab monsters still around? It clearly said that it's the source of all the magic of the oceans, and you've destroyed it, and it's brought Orlando Bloom back. It should probably have brought all of the other guys from the Flying Dutchman back. But
Oh, let's talk about that for a second as well. So, curse is broken. Javier Bardem's crew gets turned back into humans instantly. And then they all drown because they're underwater.
Yeah,
now,
essentially.
If I'm not mistaken, the Flying Dutchman spends most of its time underwater. So at some point, the crew of the Flying Dutchman is just chilling, hanging back, high-fiving sharks, just going, yep, another day, a couple more souls we've got to take care of. And then suddenly they all turn back to human, like meters under the ocean.
I think it happened. It just so happened that the curse was destroyed at the moment they were on the surface. They're on the surface.
Sure.
That's why it makes sense.
Of course.
Don't delve into it too
deeply. I'm sorry.
Sense.
I mean, how did I miss that? But look, you know what I'm going to say in a broader sense as well? Fuck post-credit sequences. I'm done with them, okay? That kind of crap where they basically... the whole point of that film was erasing all the curses that exist. And then right at the end, just before you're about to shut the film off and get on with your life, they then turn around and say, but there's still curses!
Yeah.
Sequel!
I mean, I also hate it for that reason. And it's like it's unnecessary, they're usually irrelevant, but also as a employee of the cinema when I used to work there, they're horrible because people won't leave.
Yeah.
Your job is to clean the aisles and the seats during the credits to get it ready for the next group coming through.
Yep.
But there's, you know, 10, 20, 30 people still sticking around for this 10-second sequence. It's like, I have a job to do. Please leave. It's not going to reveal anything. Yeah, it's Samuel L. Jackson, and he's like, we found a hammer. I don't know. Like, I think that was the end of Iron Man 2, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, it was. The thing is, like, the Pirates films were one of the first films to do that, because Pirates 1 has an end credit sequence. It has no real bearing on anything, aside from establishing that the monkey curses itself again.
Right.
But it's a throwaway kind of bit at the end of the film. And I guess The Matrix Reloaded had the trailer for Revolutions on the end of it as well. That's another podcast for sure. But it's, I can't stand them anymore. Like, why are you doing this? Why are you...
The only reason they're doing it is because other people are doing it, and it's just like, it's to, so Reddit sub forums can have stuff to talk about. It's the J.J. Abrams, let's leave them with a hint of mystery so it can spark the imagination. But it doesn't do that anymore.
No,
and it's just,
it doesn't. Can you imagine if
painful.
Like all the great films in the past that have had sequels, right? Imagine if The Godfather had a post-credit sequence.
You know,
like,
what did have a post-credit sequence is Back to the Future Part 2.
It did, actually. And it was just the trailer for Back to the Future 3.
It was just the trailer. I'm so surprised. I didn't realize they actually ran that.
You're right. That
when
probably,
they released, but it's also because they'd filmed that and it was pretty much ready to go.
They filmed them back to back,
and the time between cinema releases for that was like absurdly short.
Oh, well, then that answers that whole question about where did the back to back filming thing came from. Oh, sorry, Back to the Future.
Sorry, Zemeckis, you've ruined it again.
It's yeah. Go do another Polar Express.
Yeah, Polar Express 2. This time it's also, Under Siege 3, Polar Express 2. That'd be great, actually. CGI Tom Hanks trying to stop some sort of nefarious clandestine superpower from... I think Under Siege 2 was there's satellites that can shoot lasers to destroy things, so...
Isn't that Geostorm?
That is also Geostorm.
Yeah, okay. Well...
I think we'll have to wrap up there. Sorry there weren't as many jokes this week as there are in previous weeks. What we really need to do is choose a film that doesn't make us angry.
I don't know. What do we?
I mean, the option was either this or Transformers Last Night, and I really thought the last night, not late last night. I really thought Transformers was going to be a much worse film, and there's a chance that it is.
Yep.
But I thought it would be a much worse viewing experience than having to watch Pirates, because I had... And then, again, that's my own fault for getting my expectations up.
Yeah.
So.
I have a feeling that I'm going to be as angry at Transformers. Well, actually, maybe not, because I don't care about Transformers at all. At the end of the day, as I said at the start of this podcast, I do like the Pirates film. I've always enjoyed them. I think that for the first three films, Gore Verbinski brought very much a sense of grandeur to the whole world. They're immaculately shot. And there's a certain spark to them that was definitely lacking in 4 and is nowhere to be found in 5. I think that him not being on board for any of these films has really hurt them. They're films I enjoy just because they're fun to watch.
Yeah.
They're beautifully made films. And that's probably why I'm so angry at this one. Transformers has been terrible from the first one, and I don't care about them whatsoever. So sure, if I'm going to go see Marky Mark hammered up in front of a bunch of crappy CGI with an insane amount of cutting and Michael Bay's fixation on gleaming metal and hot ass, then fine.
Yeah.
Let's.
I mean, the other choices are things like Spider-Man Homecoming or Wonder Woman. I think you saw Spider-Man.
I saw Spider-Man Homecoming.
And I've seen Wonder Woman.
And I haven't seen Wonder Woman.
Maybe want me white do one of those.
Let's do Wonder Woman because I haven't liked any of the DC films that have come out.
Right, okay.
Under, what's his name? Who's directing them?
The guy. I couldn't tell you.
His name now. A famous dude who did 300.
Oh, Schneider.
Schneider. Zack Schneider.
Schneider. I was going to call him Wesley Schneider, but I think he's a Dutch international footballer, so probably not the same guy.
No, probably not. But yeah, I've not liked any of them. They've just felt just nothing but spectacle and no substance whatsoever. So I want to see if Wonder Woman sort of lives up to what everyone has been saying about it. I don't think it will, but...
All right. I mean, I suppose we could start a tradition where we talk about the films we're going to watch next week and then don't watch them at all. We'll see. We'll see if we get around to...
In that case, if we're going to do that, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, we're definitely going to watch next week.
Although we've got a bet going on for...
Yeah, we do. How's that bet going? Let's have a bet watch. Is there a new film in the Dark Universe yet?
There hasn't been one released.
Great.
Although I might argue that this Pirates of the Caribbean film and all Pirates of the Caribbean film could potentially be in the Dark Universe. No. All right. So I also wanted to discuss our sign-off. I think we've just said like, till see you next time.
Yeah, but
I'd like a phrase or something like that we can sign off with each week that we can just leave the audience with. Now, I'm gonna try one out.
Sure.
If it works, we'll just leave it.
Yep.
If it doesn't work, then you can stop me and we can try and come up with a new one.
If this podcast suddenly ends without you hearing whatever this is going to be, you know that it was crap.
All right. Okay. So you've been listening to Movie Film Studios.
Yes, you have.
I've been Isaac.
And I've been AJ.
Roll credits.